This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy to welcome to the Radio Cafe Josh Oppenheimer. He's an award-winning filmmaker. His first documentary, The Act of Killing, was nominated for an Academy Award, and his new documentary is called The Look of Silence. It's screening at the CCA. He's also a Santa Fean. Welcome, Josh, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So this is the second documentary you've made about the Indonesian genocide of 1965 and its long aftermath, and in it you confront one of the most fundamental human questions, namely, how do we human beings respond to institutionalized cruelty of human beings to one another? And what do you say when its perpetrators are right in front of you? The film follows a man named Adi, who is now in his 40s, whose brother was killed in the most brutal way during this genocide. And he and his family have been living among killers and death squad leaders ever since. The brother's killers, the mother, her son's killers, they live in the same village. They see each other. And we see Adi confronting them and asking them all the hard questions. First of all, how did you and Adi find each other and begin the process of making this film?
Well, I think that it's just worth pointing out that the idea of survivors living surrounded by perpetrators, that's not a unique situation at all. You have that in many places in the world, most obviously perhaps places like Rwanda and Cambodia. But of course, what's different here, and what it's important to just underline, because it's really what both of my films are about and what makes The Look of Silence unique, I think, in the history of cinema, is the fact that here the perpetrators are still in power. They've never been forced to acknowledge what they've done was wrong. It's a very different thing to go to the market to buy vegetables for your dinner that night and confront the men who killed your loved ones when they have to look at you shamefaced versus when they look at you proudly and defiantly and threateningly. And that's the situation in Indonesia. I met Adi in 2001. I went to Indonesia for the first time. I was asked to teach a group of agricultural workers somewhere in the world how to make a film so that they could document their own struggle to organize a union in the aftermath of a dictatorship under which unions had been illegal. And I really could have been sent anywhere for this. I was sent to Indonesia, found myself on the Belgian-owned oil palm plantation where Ramli, Adi's brother, who was killed in 1966, where his body ultimately lies, and where his grave is. And I found myself on this plantation, not knowing anything about the genocide, just discovering that the Belgian company would make the women workers do the supposedly lighter work of spraying the pesticides and the herbicides, but they would give them no protective clothing. And the workers were actually dying of liver failure in their 40s, and we realized one of the herbicides was so toxic that as the mist would get into their lungs and reach the bloodstream and ultimately get to their livers, it was dissolving the fabric of their liver tissue, and that's why they were dying. So one of the first things they did after I arrived in 2001 was to confront the company and say, look, we need protective clothing. The company responded by hiring thugs to threaten and attack the workers, who then dropped their demands immediately. I asked, how can you let this go so easily? Isn't this a matter of life and death for you? They said, it is, but our parents and our grandparents were killed in 1965 as part of a mass killing. They were members of the National Plantation Workers Union, and for that alone, they were seen as likely opponents to the new military government. They were accused of being communists, which, in fact, they weren't. Not that it would have justified what happened to them if they were, but they weren't, and they were killed. And they were afraid this could happen again, not least because these thugs were from the same paramilitary group that had committed the killings with the army back in 1965, and they were still very much in power. And after this was how I encountered the genocide for the first time. They said, come back, and why don't you make a film now about why we're still afraid decades on? And I was introduced right away when I returned in early 2003 to start that work. I was introduced right away to Adi and his family because Ramli, Adi's murdered brother, was the one victim in that region whose murder had witnesses. Tens of thousands of people had been killed, and their families never told what happened to them, which meant that the survivors couldn't grieve, couldn't work through their grief, couldn't mourn, and because they couldn't even admit to them, or admit openly to themselves that their loved ones had died. They would cling to the never quite vanishing hope that their loved ones might still be alive. But they could talk about Ramli because his murder had witnesses, and there was a body, there was ultimately a grave, and that was a way of giving voice to some of this grief. So very early on, at the start of my journey in Indonesia, back in 2003, the start of my work on this genocide, I was introduced to the family, and I fell in love with Adi's parents. They then wanted me to meet Adi, saying that he was a replacement for Ramli. He was born after the killings, and because they had him, Adi's mother said she was able to continue living. She was going crazy, she said, after Ramli died. Her husband, Rukun, another important character in The Look of Silence, lost all of his teeth in the aftermath of Ramli's murder out of stress and torment. But because they had Adi, they were able to somehow rebuild a life with him. And that's how I met the family and how I met Adi.
Adi is an optometrist, and he appears to be an incredibly calm and kind and very strong human being. And one of the ways he confronts his killers is he makes appointments for them to be tested for eyeglasses. And it's kind of amazing that his profession is so metaphorical in this case, like trying to get them to see more clearly.
Yeah, it became this amazing metaphor for a man who, for blindness, really. Here's this man whose profession it is to help people see, confronting men who are willfully blind. And midway through the show, you know, it was Adi who, after I met Adi, he latched on to my filmmaking as a way of figuring out what happened to his family, to his community, to his country, to make everybody so afraid. He started gathering survivors to tell me their stories. But in 3 weeks, also, this is still in early 2003, within 3 weeks, the army came, having given that all the survivors are under surveillance and have been since 1965, the army found out what we were doing and threatened the survivors not to participate in the film. They then called me to a midnight meeting in Adi's parents' home and said, "Don't give up, try to film the perpetrators." I was afraid to do that at first. I overcame my fear and discovered, to my astonishment and horror, that the perpetrators were open, that it took nothing to get them to open up about what they'd done. They were boastful, even. Doesn't mean they were really proud, but at least they were boastful. We can talk about that later, maybe. I think the boasting is defensive, though. But in any case, it's clearly a symptom, a manifestation of impunity, that they're boasting about what they've done. I had the feeling that I'd wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, only to find the Nazis still in power, right, with the one proviso that the rest of the world would have had to celebrate the Holocaust at the time of its occurrence for the perpetrators to boast so shamelessly and openly later. Anyways, Adi encouraged me to film the perpetrators. When he saw their boasting, he encouraged me to continue. That led to the act of killing and to the old footage with perpetrators that you see Adi watching in The Look of Silence. Yeah. Throughout that, midway through the shooting of the act of killing, I discovered that Adi was changing as a result of watching the footage that I was filming with the perpetrators. And he, as an optometrist, was deliberately seeking out people in their 70s who would either have participated in the killings or survived them, to ask them what they remembered. He would often be rebuffed and pushed away, told he's asking too deep questions. And I realized then that this was this potentially explosive metaphor. At the same time, when I returned in 2012, after editing The Act of Killing, but before it had its first screenings, at which point I knew I couldn't safely return to Indonesia again, when I returned in 2012 to make The Look of Silence, Adi said, "Having seen your footage with the perpetrators, I must confront them." And I said no at first, immediately. I said, "It's too dangerous. This has never been done in a film." He convinced me to do it. And then I realized, once we realized we could find a way of doing so safely, I realized that the eye tests would be an important part of that. That if Adi were to start by testing the perpetrators' eyes, it would somehow disarm them. Their guard would be down. They would be likely to open up about the same details of what they'd done that they'd told me years earlier, and that would give Adi a basis with which to confront them. Of course, Adi could say, "I know you said this, this, and this to Joshua years earlier," but that would that would prevent there from being any of the dialogue that Adi was hoping for. You see, Adi was hoping that the men would, he would be able to get them to acknowledge what they did was wrong and therefore forgive them. And if he could do that, he felt that he could reconcile his family with the families of the killers, and his children need not live in fear of their neighbors the way he and his parents have ever since the killings.
As you say, and this is the most amazing and sort of horrifying part of the film, the killers seem to be perfectly happy to speak to you. They show little or no remorse, regret, moral reflection. They're boastful. And yet there's little tiny tells, you know, with people's eyes and their body language and their facial expressions. I was thinking as I was watching the film, no actor could do this. I mean, the subtlety of it, which is so beautifully shown in the film, I mean, it's horrifyingly shown in the film. But, you know, it leads to this question that, or this whole idea that moral reckoning, whether it be on the part of an individual or a nation, about brutality perpetrated, tends not to happen all by itself. You need pressure from the outside. You need historical change. And in this case, your first film and now this film, are the agents of that change, to at least to some extent? What does that look like? I know you have, you know, you can't really go there anymore, but what's happening in Indonesia?
The act of killing helped catalyze a fundamental transformation in how the media, the mainstream media, especially talks about the past. Whereas before, there was, with very few exceptions, there was silence or the celebration of the extermination of the Indonesian left. Now the media talks about a genocide, and they talk about the criminal regime that the perpetrators have built and which has been in place ever since, openly. And the film, The Act of Killing, started its life in secret. Ultimately, there were thousands of public screenings of the film. We made the film available for free online in Indonesia, which then meant that millions of people saw the film. And when it was nominated for an Academy Award in 2014, the president's office said, look, we know what happened in 1965 was a crime against humanity, and we do need to have truth and reconciliation. That, you could say that that process opened the way for The Look of Silence, which has had a much wider release. It's distributed by two government bodies, the Jakarta Arts Council and the National Human Rights Commission. The first screening of the film was held in Indonesia's largest theater, a venue for 1,500 people. There were billboards around Jakarta announcing the screening. 3,000 people turned up, so they put on two screenings. Adi came as a surprise guest and received a 15-minute standing ovation. A month later, the film came out around the country with 500 public screenings on the first day, and now we're at over 3,500 screenings, and we estimate 300,000 people have seen the film. The film was called the film of the year by much of the Indonesian media last year, and the film has prompted the Indonesian Association of History Teachers to write an alternative history curriculum to say, this is the official story, this is what we're supposed to teach, and now this is the truth. That involves for 11th and 12th graders showing my films in school. It's a very big, it's a change. You can say that if The Act of Killing forced a discussion about what happened and the corruption and the impunity in the present, the second film has come into that space and said, look how urgently truth and reconciliation are needed. Look how destroyed, how torn the fabric of Indonesian society is. That sort of links back to your question, where you said that although the perpetrators appear to be remorseless, there's these little cracks, these little glimpses you see when Adi confronts them. And I think that's the key to the impact of The Look of Silence inside Indonesia. Adi comes, of course, if they didn't feel remorse, if they were truly proud, they would simply say, yes, this is what we did, so what? They wouldn't get defensive. Defensiveness betrays guilt. And Adi comes to them with this gentle, humanizing gaze, showing them, look, if you can only take responsibility, I can see you as a human being and I can forgive you. I mean, I see you as a human being no matter what, but I can forgive you as a human being. And that doesn't make it easier for them. It makes it harder because they're forced to return that gaze. and see Adi as a human being. By extension, Adi's murdered brother as a human being and all their victims as a human being. They're forced, that is to say, to confront the meaning of what they've done. The simple precision of Adi's gaze functions like the fictional dramatizations in the act of killing is a mirror in which the perpetrators see themselves, and they become. And I told Adi, I do not think we will get the. I said, I do not think we will get the apology you're hoping for. I think the perpetrators will panic when they're challenged by you in this way. But I think if I can show those reactions, with if I can show why we fail to get that apology with precision, with empathy, with intimacy, then we can make visible this abyss of fear that's dividing everyone in this society and make ensure that anyone who sees our film in Indonesia is forced to acknowledge the prison of fear in which they're living and being asked to raise their children and inevitably lead them to support truth, reconciliation, and justice. So hopefully we'll succeed, I said, in a much bigger way through the film where we might fail in the individual confrontations.
We're talking to Josh Oppenheimer about his documentary, The Look of Silence. There's a bizarre moment in the film early on where we see an NBC news broadcast from that time, 1965-66, in which an Indonesian, I guess it's a military guy, is telling the American reporter that communists willingly presented themselves to be killed, like they wanted to be killed. And the reporter didn't challenge him. And that leads to a really, I think, important question, which is what the United States' role was in this genocide. I mean, one of the people in the film actually says something like, we did this because the Americans taught us to hate communists. What was the U.S. role?
Well, the United States, at the very least, supplied a certain amount of weapons, money, and training to the death squads. They may have been, we know that the U.S. Embassy was compiling lists of thousands of names of Indonesian public figures, writers, journalists, teachers, doctors, union leaders, the ethnic Chinese to have killed, basically inciting the army to kill everybody who might be opposed to the new regime, because the United States wanted this new regime to stick. We know the United States started providing what would ultimately become billions, tens of billions of dollars in aid to the new military dictatorship while the corpses were still rotting on the ground across the country. And we know, we see in the film, that American corporations immediately exploited in brutal ways the terrible conditions, the terrible labor conditions and resources of Indonesia. There's a moment in The Look of Silence where we learn that an American multinational from the same NBC news broadcast, in fact, reports rather cheerfully that Goodyear, one of the world's largest tire and rubber corporations, was using slaves drawn from death camps to harvest the latex that goes into our tires and our condoms. This is just 20 years after German corporations were using slaves from death camps on the periphery of Auschwitz. And this is a pretty profound stain on the U.S.'s claim to be a force for freedom and democracy in the post-war world. And more importantly, it should lead us, I think, to question whether U.S. support was really offered in the name of the struggle of the free world against the so-called communist world, which is what we would be had to believe, or whether that was in fact ideological anti-communism, perhaps like anti-terrorism today, was often twisted into a kind of pretext to justify greed, and greed of the most murderous sort, that is to say, murderous plunder. That really is a pretty damning moment, I think, in the film. And the true depth of American involvement, whether we just supported and championed what happened or whether we really caused the genocide, remains unknown. All of the CIA job documents from 1964 to 1966 in Indonesia, all of the military attaché documents from the U.S. Embassy from that period remain classified, despite numerous attempts to have them declassified. And New Mexico's Senator Tom Udall, after seeing the act of killing and learning more about this issue, introduced a sense of the Senate resolution last December 10th, International Human Rights Day, the same day that the Look of Silence came out around Indonesia, calling for the United States to declassify its documents that would reveal what we did exactly, how we were involved. He said more or less, look, 50 years is too long not to call a crime against humanity a crime against humanity, and we cannot encourage an apology and an acknowledgement of what happened inside Indonesia without being hypocrites unless we also acknowledge our role in what happened, and we need to do that. There's in fact a way that sense of the Senate resolution now needs to be reintroduced in the Senate because there's a new Congress. You can support that resolution by going to www.thelookofsilence.com/participate, or there's a button on the main page that says participate. You can sign a petition urging other lawmakers to sign up to Senator Udall's resolution.
In addition to everything else, The Look of Silence is an extraordinary work of filmmaking. And from the way we've been talking, maybe our listeners on the radio might not guess that there is a sense of beauty and quiet and breathing space in this film. And I was wondering if you could talk for a moment about the aesthetics of the film.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about it in relation to the act of killing, in fact. I see The Look of Silence as a kind of poem composed in memoriam for all that's been destroyed. And by that, I don't just mean the dead, the people murdered in 1965, which is, I think, what maybe many films would focus on. I would say that this film is not about, neither of my films are about what happened in 1965 as such. They're about the long shadow of the genocide when there's no justice. And in this case, I'm trying to show what's been destroyed by 50 years of fear. What does it do to human beings to have to live in fear for 50 years? I tried to create a poem that is sort of backward-looking, that says, whatever truth, reconciliation, and justice might come in the future, all the lives that have been broken by half a century of fear can never be made whole again. And we have to acknowledge that and accept that because that's part of who we are. And it's part of who we are in America, too, insofar as the 1965 genocide was part of American history as well. It's part of, and so many other atrocities across the global South that are similar are part of our history, and so many atrocities at home. The Native American genocide, the history of slavery and apartheid, something we've been reminded of again and again in painful ways this last year. But I really, in trying to create a poem about silence, it involves being very quiet and very intimate and training my lens in very precise ways on the subtle traces of that. It's a bit of a shame that in the United States what was released as The Act of Killing is in fact a cut down, 40 minutes shorter than the unabridged complete film which was released everywhere else in the world. It's the complete film is maybe a gentler and also a more quiet work and a deeper work. And it's available in the U.S. online, on Netflix, on DVD, and on Blu-ray as the director's cut. But it's not a director's cut because director's cuts are made afterwards and out of regret. This is the original film. And it's cut through by these moments of absolute silence that are similar to the silence that haunted spaces in The Look of Silence. They were shot at the same time. And these are moments where the uncut act of killing, the director's cut of the act of killing, shifts perspective from the perpetrators, the delirium of the perpetrators, to the absent dead, whom I hope haunt the whole of the act of killing. And in making The Look of Silence, I'd already edited the act of killing, and I knew that I wanted to bring the viewer into any of these haunted silences that punctuate the director's cut of the act of killing and make you feel what is it like to have to live there. And to do that, I'd bring you very close to one family. Adi, the main character, becomes like you or your brother, and his parents become like your parents or your grandparents. His children become like your children. That sort of is in out of step with maybe the normal documentary practice of interviewing multiple families and trying to extrapolate from that some typical stories and experiences. such extrapolation would be an abstraction. An extrapolation is inevitably distant from lived experience. I try to put you right at the center of this family. There's really no interviews in the film as such. It's all scenes where we're immersed in these situations in real intimacy. And then there's these haunted space in which the family lives, and this feeling of ghosts, of the unburied and sometimes even unmourned dead all around.
And people will just have to see it, because it's hard to even describe Adi's mother and his father and the profundity of the emotion, which is never overwrought. You know, it's a I'm sure big cultural difference as well, but it's an absolutely stunning film. I recommend that everybody see it. I know that there are a lot of people who might think it's too heavy for them, but you know what, ladies and gentlemen, just go anyway and see this film. It's called The Look of Silence. It's screening at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. You can find out more at thelookofsilence.com. Josh Oppenheimer, filmmaker, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.